Hello and welcome to the latest edition of TribCast. I am in the Multimedia Lounge with Evan Smith, Ross Ramsey, and Ben Philpott. My name is Elise Hugh, and everybody brings a different topic to the table in the TribCast, and Evan gets to start with his topic this week. Evan?
Elise, my interest this week is in the degree to which the national political environment will impact Texas elections next year. I think there is going to be an Obama effect to some degree, but I just can't figure out what it is. The obvious thought would be that if Obama is not more popular in a year than he is today, that a number of Texas Democrats may suffer because there'll be depressed turnout among Democrats. There'll be independents who might have supported Obama before who cross over and vote Republican. And there may be specific races that are closer or even up for grabs as a result. One that's often cited is Chet Edwards, the congressman from Waco, Democrat who is reasonably close to Obama, so close that he was considered for vice president.
Right.
In a district like Waco, Ross, Obama may not be very popular, and shots of Chet Edwards palling around with Obama may not quite rise to the level of William Ayers, but it might not help Edwards if he finds a serious opponent among the Republicans in that race.
It's the most Republican congressional district in the United States that's represented by a Democrat. It was George Bush's home deal when he lived in Crawford. Chet Edwards has done a really interesting job of walking this line for years, you know, being reelected. He had a race a few years ago against Arlene Wolgamuth, who was a state legislator who got visits from Bush and from Cheney and from everybody, and that didn't put him over the top. But this time, you know, with the environment like it is, as you say, this thing could be in play. Chet Edwards, in fact, was the only Texas Democrat who voted against the health care plan.
Which really interested me because I figured that Edwards, ideologically, in the absence of risk, might have gone with the health care plan.
So maybe that shows exactly how close it is, that if he's willing to vote against it, that
he's afraid.
He's seen something that says, I'm going to have to vote against this.
Now, the rumor is that the Wolgamuth this year may be Steve Ogden, the now retiring state senator from Bryan,
right,
who would pose, I assume, a competitive threat to Edwards?
He would be a serious threat. The district stretches from Bryan up to Waco. Waco's probably got more population in it, but if you get the Republicans excited in this thing in Brazos County and up through the district. Interestingly, in the Wolgamuth race, the main issue was the Children's Health Insurance Program. And Edwards made this now famous campaign ad where he had a young Anglo widow sitting in the backyard, you know, somewhere in the background, a kid is swinging and she's saying, you know, my kid needs health care. And, you know, the take on that in the district was, you know, that could be one of our kids. And it took what Chip was sort of framed as an urban health care program, and it sort of framed it differently, and he fought that race successfully on health care. It's interesting now that he's kind of running away from it. But Ogden would be a big threat to him. The environment, I think, would be the biggest threat. If the environment stays like it is now, he's got potential race.
But I think the issue is not just Edwards. I think the issue is across the state. The question is whether Obama does become a factor in races not just in the Senate or the Congress, but kind of in local races. In other words, does Obama become a negative effect?
To the national mood, I would say it's still too far out. I mean, obviously in 2006, the whole Mark Foley – or it was 2006. The whole Mark Foley thing didn't even happen until about 30 days out from Election Day, and it changed a lot of things in terms of tipping the House.
This was a
races.
Republican congressman caught philandering with pages.
Not just pages, but mail pages.
Mail pages, right.
Right.
And to the Chet Edwards issue, I'll draw on my 9 months in Waco, my nine painful months in Waco, to say the man knows every person in that district. And he's worked very hard to secure money for Fort Hood. Most of the population of that district is in McLennan County, which is where Waco is. I consider him almost Teflon, but obviously it is an issue given with what Ben said, how he voted on health care.
Well, a race that I think will be interesting on – more local level, Valinda Bolton in southwest Travis County. So she gets swept in against a moneyed Republican two elections ago, Bill Welch. Mm-hmm. Is that right? So I kind of thought that was based on the fact that Democrats in that district all of a sudden got their chance to vote for Lloyd Doggett. He had been banished from because of redistricting from most of Austin. They had redrawn the lines. He was now – the Democrats in southwest Travis County got a chance to vote for Doggett, and there were Doggett signs all over the place,
right,
and she wins. Now, that was also not a great year for Republicans. Bill Welch said anybody who ran against her with an R against their name was gonna lose.
Bill, or rather, George Bush was having the midterm election that year that the right. Democrats are afraid Obama's about to have next year.
This was all 2006,
and this was 2006. So then 2008, with Obama on the ticket and Democrats energized, she barely beats Donna Keel, who had the Keel name because Keel. Terry Keel had that district forever.
Terry Keel, Patrick Keel, it's a really well-known name on the Austin.
And so now she's got, you know, with Obama, she barely wins. Now she may be with Obama, but for the wrong reason, in a district that, you know, I think that's going to be an interesting one to see how it kind of rolls there.
Yeah. The issue is always what the environment is when the election comes around. I mean, you know, these things are hard to analyze because you don't know, as Elise said, you don't know exactly what we're going to be talking about in October of 2010. If we're talking about, well, isn't it interesting how the economy has recovered and how car sales have gone and Chrysler survived.
And by the way, healthcare passed
and all of that, yada, yada,
Osama bin Laden has been captured.
Then for the Democrats,
always
the clouds,
dreaming, Ben.
Right, the clouds part, the angels sing, it looks like a Monty Python cartoon. But, you know, if the environment in a year or in 11 months, more to the point, is what it is now, the Democrats are going to have a hard piece of sledding here.
Right, but to pick up on your Monty Python analogy, if things aren't better, then the big foot comes down and lands on whoever the Democratic gubernatorial nominee is,
right,
and on everybody else. Mm-hmm. I'll be curious to see a year from now, let's say Tom Schieffer is the nominee.
Mm-hmm.
Does Tom Schieffer run away from Obama as the Democratic nominee, or does Tom Schieffer run toward Obama? Does that help him in the fall? Does he figure he has a free pass because it's not going to win anyway? And so he can basically embrace the base, or does he compound his problems by running away from the base?
Well, you know, you see this with every president. I mean, there were times in George Bush's presidency when every single Republican candidate running for office wanted George Bush to be in a picture with them.
And then,
there were times when every single Republican candidate in the country said, like, you know, I've never really met the president. I don't really know him.
Let's have him come into the convention via satellite.
It's completely variable. It's just sort of based on the issue environment that you're in when the election comes up.
And as we start talking about elections, Ross, I know your topic is also pretty timely.
Chuck Hobson changed parties. And this actually relates back to the other thing. Chuck Hobson is in a district in East Texas. He's from Jacksonville. It's a 4-county district. And he won by 120 votes in 2008 over a relatively weak Republican challenger. And this is a district that's been marginal for a long time. Chuck Hobson's never gotten, in a contested election, he's never gotten more than 53 or 54%. Most often it's around 50, 51%. This time it was 120 votes. And Hobson came back and was saying the things that he was hearing door to door, running on the ticket with Obama and Biden, were flatly racist and were, you know, really harsh, and that the viewpoints in that district were strongly against, you know, they were pretty solidly against Democrats as a Republican district, but they were very strongly against this president in particular. And I think all of that figured into his decision in the past week to change parties. He's jumping over to the Republicans. As we record this, they're planning a thing for Saturday where John Cornyn and the U.S. Senator and Todd Staples, the Agriculture Commissioner, and some others are going to come down and, you know, courthouse steps with Chuck Hobson, put their arms around him, and try to help him through a Republican primary.
Which he has.
Right,
which
how tough is that, gauging?
Well, the Republican, you know, the hardest thing for a party switcher is to run in your first primary. The general election is easier, but you run into the first primary, and the first thing that happens is, in Chuck Hobson's case, he's going to be running in a Republican primary with a largely Democratic voting record. He's going to be running against someone. Michael Banks is a dentist in town. They've been friends for 35 years. It's a really interesting kind of backstory. But Michael Banks is running against him. And he's going to say, you know, I've been a Republican all along. Chuck Hobson's been a Republican for about 90 days now. I've been with you all the way through. I voted for this Republican with you. I voted for this Republican with you. Chuck Hobson didn't.
So what was the point for the Republicans to get Hobson to switch parties in that case? Was it so Hobson would run and win and be elected and serve as a Republican, or was it to pick off Hobson by having him not be a Democrat, knowing that any other Democrat can't win that district?
Right. This is the old joke, you know, the veterinarian and the taxidermist start a store together, and the slogan is either way you get your dog back. The Republicans in this case, they either get Chuck Hobson, they get Dr. Banks. Either way, they've got a Republican, and it's no longer a Democratic district. For them, it's a win.
Right. But, you know, it's hard to get anybody else to switch parties when you discover that the welcome you get by the Republican Party is essentially a Joe Sestak challenge to
– Well, and I mean, I think
that the Pennsylvania Senate race is interesting in the same respect, because you got Arlen Specter, who switched from Republican to Democrat, and immediately Admiral Joe Sestak, who's a House member, a Democrat, a Netroots-type Democrat, steps up to challenge Specter. And Specter's probably thinking, what does a guy have to do to get a break here? And Hobson's probably thinking, you know, you guys got me over here. You didn't tell me about the problem of a primary challenge.
But I think the Republican establishment is going to secure that Hobson gets through that primary.
What are they going to do? They're going to do laughing gas on Dr. Banks? What are they going to do?
They're going to do everything they can. I mean, you know, one of the interesting things here is if there is a – you're running in a Republican primary. The Democrats are looking at this and saying, Chuck Hobson is running against us with money we gave him. He had a fundraiser in Austin 2 weeks ago raising money from Democrats. So they're plenty mad. They want this to fail. They want to teach everybody else that you don't switch parties. So what they're going to do is either overtly or covertly get support to the other guy, so that the lesson here is if you switch parties, you lose. So if I'm a Democratic plotter, what I'm going to try to do is get Michael Banks some help in the primary so Chuck Hobson gets beat, to teach everybody else don't do that.
That's pretty cynical.
Ben, do you think it's possible for the Democrats to mount any challenge to Hobson at all?
Probably not. I mean, it's kind of like the same kind of situation you have up in Wichita Falls, where that was another district that the Democrat who held it, Farabee, once he announced that he was not going to run again, it's now a Republican district. So, you know, they've got some races that they can win. So where do they stick their money? I mean, do they stick their money against Hobson in a general election, or do they stick their money against Irving, Texas. My name's
Linda Harper Brown.
Yeah. Thank you.
Or against Ken Legler.
Yeah, the two. Yeah, the
or Bohack.
Yeah, yeah, Bohack, Legler. You know, there are several target districts. The big table here is that, you know, you start with a House that's 76 Republicans, 74 Democrats. The Farabee seat goes in Wichita Falls, and you know, in front of a microphone, most of the Democrats will say, well, it's competitive. Off the mic, they'll say, you know, no, that seat's gone.
Gone.
So,
and Hobson, they have to figure, is gone.
Hobson, right. Hobson's the same thing.
Now you're at 78, 72.
So now you've got to really win some seats. Most of the seats that are in play this time are held by Democrats. So for the most part, the Democrats are going to be playing defense and not offense. Now they've got to win three offensive seats and be successful in all the defenses.
It's and then we tough. Go back to the whole environment question.
Right.
Well, and the fact is, to Ben's point, you know, are they better off spending their money to try to defend seats that they may lose? You know, is the money better spent on helping Christy Tebow or Robert Miklos or Chris Turner or Carol Kent, or is the money better spent
or
Linda Bolton, or is the money better spent on trying to find a Democrat to beat Chuck Hobson or even Michael Banks, which is almost certainly, you know, too much of a task to be accomplished.
And it's really cynical of me to say, but where are they going to find a good, credible Democrat in that district?
In Jacksonville.
Right.
There's good, credible Democrats over there. They're just – the votes aren't – you know, the vote base isn't there. The, you know, it's just a – it's a Republican district. If you look at that district in other elections, you know, how they vote in presidential elections and U.S. Senate elections, you know, it's a – that's red country.
Hobson was the outlier.
Right.
Right.
What
right.
was it? His district, 80% went for McCain, something like that?
71% went for McCain.
71, okay.
So.
And he held the seat because he was the incumbent. Which is the case for a lot of those WD-40s.
Well, and that's the trick here. The Democrats, if they want to play here at all, want to knock him off in the Republican primary, because that's the easiest place to knock off a Democrat. And then they go into the general election without an incumbent. It's probably not a great chance, but it's their best chance.
Because Banks, in theory, is more beatable.
Because
as some Democrats will cross over and vote for Hobson out of loyalty in the fall, despite the fact that Hobson now self-identifies as a Republican.
Right.
Yep.
Right?
Right.
I want to talk about a Republican who's facing Republican primary challengers. Delwin Jones, State Representative Delwin Jones of Lubbock. He was first elected to the House in 1964, took a break in between, but is now serving at 85 or 86 years old, and has caught two Republican challengers next year in his primary. So what's up with that is my question.
Well, he gets a challenger every time. I mean, you know, Delwin's been, you know, actually the guy that beat him in 1973 was Pete Laney after a redistricting fight. Delwin sat out for 16 years, came back in 1989, like you said. He's, you know, when you look at Delwin Jones, you go, that guy's so old, there's no way he could be competitive in an election. They do this every time. Delwin Jones had a piece of heart surgery a few years ago. I think it was a bypass. And the first picture that appears from this heart surgery is Delwin Jones sitting in his hospital bed, picture of him in the Lubbock Avalanche Journal, signing the filing documents, I'm running again. Joe Strauss went out there. The speaker went out there a couple of weeks ago for a Joe Strauss Appreciation Day at Texas Tech. Delwin Jones did this thing. And you kind of go, you kind of roll your eyes and you go, oh, my God, this is going to be some kind of event.
And we should mention Delwin Jones is one of the ABC Gang of 11 Republicans who was responsible for the insurgency that allowed Joe Strauss to be speaker today. So
Strauss goes out there, and you think this is going to be BS. And they go out there, and there were 960 people at this lunch.
Is that right?
Delwin Jones got a crowd. He's a formidable campaigner. He's handed out – somebody told me the other day he's handed out over the years 17,000 Emory boards that say Delwin Jones on them. It's old school stuff.
I love Delwin Jones.
The guy's running against him.
Emory boards?
Emory boards.
Like nail file
like
Emory boards?
Like nail file Emory boards. Yeah, this is old school. In East Texas, it's funeral fans, right? You hand out the fans they use at funerals, right? Do this all through the South, right? In West Texas, it's Emory boards. Susan Combs hands out those blue combs.
Those
all
combs,
over the place.
Right? Yeah,
it's, you know, everybody's got a Jake Pickle used to hand out those little pickles. There's a couple in every reporter's desk drawer, I think. But so Delwin Jones is a working guy. Zach Brady is a former aide to Robert Duncan. Came up through the Senate. He's a lawyer now. He's really energetic. He raised $100,000 in his first 6 weeks out of the thing. It's going to be a tough campaign.
Is Duncan going to support Delwin?
Duncan, I think, is probably staying out of this thing at this point. But
right. Which is tantamount to not supporting Delwin.
Well, it's, you know, some of my friends are for this, some of my friends are against this. I'm for my friends. I think that's where he is right now. I test the waters.
Well, at least he doesn't have a speaker against him this time around.
Well, that's right. Doesn't have Tom Craddock working against
him. I was interested in the story that ran in the paper. I guess it was in the American Statesman this week, a Gardner Selby piece about the congressman in Texas, U.S. congressman. Many of the Republicans, Mike Conaway was the poster child for this, but I think there were a couple of others, who have challengers in the primary, who have Tea Party challengers in the primary. And, you know, we are seeing a time when there is a Republican litmus test being asked of these folks. And I think in Delwin's case, it's a little bit more easy to understand.
Right.
Because Delwin has always been an apostate. The A in anybody but Craddock could stand for apostate just as easily. And so you can understand where some of the farther right elements of that party would prefer to see Delwin out.
Right.
But in the case of some of these U.S. congressmen, these are reliable conservatives.
There's an interesting.
Yes, but they're establishment, so we must get rid of them.
Right.
Well, there are some, you know, I mean,
we hate the establishment.
Don't diminish this. There are some legitimate differences here of opinion. I mean, you've got some people that are real economic conservatives and really don't care about social conservatism. And the Republican Party, the part of the Republican Party that's gone over to social conservatism and has been less conservative economically, has riled these guys up.
And they're
kind of cranky.
And yet,
about
the
it.
Point I'd make is it's not simply the moderate versus conservative fight, it's conservative versus extremely conservative.
Well, and it's also, we talked about this a little bit last week when we were talking about Deborah Medina. There's also a real establishment, anti establishment strain going on here that I think is really important.
And that's to Ben's point, right?
Yeah, and then I think that's going to be really interesting. I mean, you've got a governor who put his hat in the ring with the anti establishment conservative in New York for that congressional race.
Right.
And they lost. I mean, all the, you know, it was Perry, it was Palin.
Tim Pawlenty.
Pawlenty, everyone going after this, the conservative party candidate up in New York. I still wonder how far that will then go here in Texas. I mean, will you see more people either registering as, you know, conservative? I mean, there's not a conservative party, but I mean, just to see how these candidates, you know, come out and whether or not they will then receive backing from some of the, you know, establishment, even though they're anti-establishment candidates.
Right.
But will they receive backing from people like Perry and others?
One of the things that has protected Democrats in races like Valinda Bolton's and races like Chuck Hobson's has been the presence in general elections of libertarians. And I'm curious to see in this election if there are independent votes that show up from the teabaggers that don't run in – some of these aren't going to run in Republican primaries. The libertarians in Texas don't pick their candidates until May or June, depends on when their convention is. And when you have that third party in there, sometimes that bleeds away enough Republican votes that you'll see a Democrat winning an election because the votes got bled off. I think that happened in one of Valinda's elections. It happened with a number of Democrats over the last two or three cycles.
Yeah, I do think there was, I think maybe 3% for the libertarian candidate in the last election. I mean, something enough that, you know, what, she won by 1% or less.
Right.
It'll be interesting to see if Medina who will presumably emerge not victorious from the gubernatorial primary, returns to her Ron Paul roots and runs as a third-party candidate in the fall. Now, you know, unlikely to have a spoiler effect in the fall, more so in the primary, but still could be pretty interesting. And I keep wondering when Ron Paul's going to get in the Senate race, if there is a Senate
race. That's a real spoiler. I mean, he's got $2 million in his account. He's got a name that, you know, when Ron Paul gets on the ballot, you know, he ran for president a few years ago as a Libertarian. He ran for president as a Republican. He's got a national fundraising base. He's got a national following. He can raise money like that.
His son is having quite a run in Kentucky for the Senate. I mean, using a lot of his dad's techniques. This is a case of the apple
and
not falling far from
and
the tree.
He's the anti-establishment candidate. I mean, for a conservative who feels fed up with whatever the party's doing, they can feel sheltered in a Ron Paul Republican candidacy.
Right.
Ben has a surprise topic for us. Sorry
does
to
it
interrupt
involve,
this
Does it involve shampoo again?
It does not involve shampoo or hair care.
We usually tell each other what our topics are going to be, but Ben is surprising us with a topic. Ben.
So, okay, there's a lot been made of the obviously over the Hispanic voting bloc and what as the demographics change within the state, what will happen with that voting bloc. But I want to bring up a different demographic that has been getting a lot of attention. So the LA Times this week says that Texas is the new Florida for retirees. The coastline is much cheaper than Florida. And that people are moving here, especially in the Galveston area where everything's cheap because it all got flattened. People are moving here in droves to retire to Texas. Now, I would bet that 65-year-olds have a better voting record than
almost any other demographic.
Yeah. So what does that do?
It presents certain policy challenges, obviously, since older people tend not to want to, you know, agree to higher property taxes for schools, for instance, because they don't have kids in schools and various concerns in terms of the way they vote.
Well, I think it also could be people that are don't want to, you know, those are the people that don't want Medicare messed with, or would not mind if it was bolstered under a new health care plan, although I don't know that it is being bolstered under the new health care plan. I haven't been able to read all 12 billion pages. But
the overgeneralization here is that they vote in greater strength than any other demographic, that they vote more conservatively than most demographics.
But they tend to be more small-C conservative rather than big-C conservative,
That's right. Yeah, they're not voting, you know, big social issue things. They're voting things like you're talking about, property taxes. They're voting
wallet
schools,
stuff.
Wallet stuff, economics, 401ks, bailouts, all that kind of things.
So what does it say about when Texas becomes Florida? I haven't read this.
It just says that it's the place of choice. It's now the cheaper retirement area. And, you know, you've seen some of this over the last several years with just the University of Texas now owns a retirement home or was building one over at Steiner Ranch. Mm-hmm. I think it's open
this
by now.
This is Steiner Ranch in Austin, right?
Right, yes. Retirement economies have already been growing in the last few years in Texas, and you know now if you want cheap coastline, this is where you come. And although the insurance,
I would say the heat will scare them off, but it hasn't seemed to work in Scottsdale, Arizona. So I don't guess the heat's going to scare them away.
I think as we consider the impact of demographic change, that's a pretty interesting one. And if the numbers get to be that significant, it could counterbalance some of the stuff that's coming in a couple of years.
Well, some of these things have these things can pop up on you. There was a deal in Polk County, Texas a few years ago called the Escapees. It's one of these RV clubs. It's a national RV club.
Right.
They got post office boxes in Polk County, Texas, down by Livingston. And there were something, the numbers were always spongy, but there were something like 10,000 of these people. And they would basically, their mailboxes in Polk County, Texas, and that's where they'd declare residency. Residency under Texas law is largely a state of mind. So they declare residency, and then they get in their RV, and they drive all over wherever you drive to get all those stickers on the back of your RV. And then they come home and check their mail and vote. And it was this sort of hidden voting block in Polk County, Texas. It played really heavily in a Senate race, a state Senate race, and in a state House race. If you get a sudden influx of people of, you know, whatever demographic into one district or one area, you can get this what the heck result. And, you know, depending on where they're moving, if they're all moving into Craig Island's district in Galveston, you know, he's got a new piece of political work to do.
Maybe Delwyn Jones is safe after all.
Maybe Delwyn Jones is okay, you know. Ski Lubbock, right?
And on that note, we'll close out this week's Tribcast. Thank you, Evan Ross and Ben, for joining us once again. And thank you for listening.